Morning, I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. 9:00 a.m., April 3rd, 2007. Joining me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Dyson, Senator Thomas, Senator Elton. We're going to have on the agenda today, we're going to have two items. Senate Bill 62, we're going to have a hearing on it, establishing an advisory committee on public reporting of healthcare-associated infections. And when we finish that, we're going to go to Senate Bill Number 4, revisions of senior care program. I'd like to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 62, establishing the advisory committee on public reporting of healthcare-associated infections. The intent is not to move this bill today, but to have a hearing for informational purposes and discussion. I'm going to allow the sponsor to go ahead and introduce the bill, and then we'll start our dialogue. With us today, representing Senator Gary Stevens, Mr. Doug Letch.
That's correct. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be back before the Senate Finance Committee today. For the record, my name is Doug Letch. I'm staff to Senator Gary Stevens. Senator Stevens was unable to join us this morning due to other commitments. Here to talk to you about Senate Bill Number 62, which would set up the Advisory Committee on Public Reporting of Healthcare-Associated Infections within the HES Department, Health Department of Health and Social Services. This bill came out of work that was done during the past interim by a task force to assess the public reporting of healthcare-associated infections. This was a group of four lawmakers, Senator Stevens, Senator Davis, Representative Gatto, Representative Wilson, and six other folks from the healthcare industry and a couple of healthcare consumers from one from Anchorage and one from rural Alaska, or Homer in this case. And one of those members is Dr. Jay Butler, who is the director of the Division of Public Health in the Department of Health and Social Services now, and at the time was the state epidemiologist and very versed in this field, and he's with us today and can talk a little bit more about this particular issue. What the SB 62 will do is set up this advisory committee, which would include one member of the Senate, one member of the House, and nine members appointed by the governor, which would include two physicians with significant experience in the area of infectious diseases, a representative of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a representative of the Alaska chapter of the Association of Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology, a representative of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, a healthcare consumer from urban Alaska, a healthcare consumer from rural Alaska, and a statistician. And this group over the coming years would be responsible for developing recommendations for collecting, analyzing, and distributing information related to healthcare-associated infections. And by January 2009, the advisory committee would provide recommendations to the department for setting up a pilot program for public reporting of healthcare-associated infections. And by January of 2011, the committee would provide the legislature report addressing the unique challenges that we face here in Alaska, and there are many, given our geographical distance and the fact that there are often just one healthcare facility in many of our communities. So that's going to be one part of their role, and we think that's a good approach to this whole problem here in the state of Alaska. We've included some information in your packets, at least just some of the multitude of information on this whole issue of healthcare-associated infections. It's a huge, huge deal in the United States, and I would say around the world. We've seen reports that an estimated 90,000 people are dying as a result of infections that they get while going in to be treated on things. And it's a cost to consumers here in the U.S. of $4.5 to $11 billion a year. So when this issue first surfaced with Senator Stevens last year, one of his close friends had gone into the hospital for treatment and wound up nearly dying from a staph infection. So that got Senator Stevens' attention, and we started taking a look at that. And it's amazing what you can find out when you're looking at this type of issue. We're not trying to target any particular hospital in the state. We're not saying that you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong. But we are trying to find a way of making the public aware of what risks they may face, and also get people's attention to do within the healthcare facility business to do simple steps that may reduce the risk of infections. And that's basically our goal. Dr. Butler can answer a lot more of the technical questions about the issue, and he really helped us quite a bit to develop the language in the bill, and we think it's a good approach to the issue. It's not forcing anything down anybody's throats, and it's giving the industry a chance to step forward and help find ways to deal with this serious problem. Thank you.
Do we have any initial questions for Mr. Lynch? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You say that 90,000 people per year mm-hmm. were dying of hospital-acquired infections, or just infections in general?
Well, that's what our, through the chair, Senator Olson, that's what our reports that we've looked at have said, that an estimated 90,000 people die as a result of infections that are gained in healthcare facilities. And it could be not just hospitals, but other clinics or other facilities as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lutz, do you have any estimate, if you boil that number down to Alaska?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I don't have that information in particular, but that may be something that Dr. Butler could speak to. I'm not sure if the department has started tracking those type of things yet, but he's followed all of the issues that have been developing in other states in regards to this area.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Doug, for the presentation. And this may be a question that you want to defer to somebody else, but I mean, I understand, I think, the basic notion here that the consumer needs to know what the incidents might be so that they can do some, for lack of a better term, comparison shopping. In Alaska, maybe especially so in Southeast Alaska, the choice might be Bartlett Hospital or Ketchikan General Hospital, or Swedish or Virginia Mason or a vet's hospital down south. And so I'm assuming that we can't force Virginia Mason to reveal what the incidence of infections are. How do you deal with that? I mean, there's only one community in Alaska really that has a choice. And I mean, how do you deal with that?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that's one of the questions that came up quite a bit during the discussion that we had in the interim task force, because we do have many communities in Alaska that only have one choice of healthcare, and that's one of the issues that in the few meetings that we did have due to the other things that were going on last interim, that we meaning the being the task force realized that it just wasn't something that can be resolved with a one-size-fits-all type issue. So that's one of the things that we would ask this task force to come up with workable recommendations for public reporting in all of these areas. And I know that there's a very small community, you know, throw out any name you want off the road system where somebody might be one of 50 patients that comes into that facility that week and develops some sort of infection. That's an issue, because in small towns, everybody's going to know who that is. There's a lot of confidentiality issues, and that's one of the tasks that I think this advisory committee will need to wrap itself around, and it's something that we couldn't do in three meetings back during the interim. When we started the process, I think we looked at it as okay, this is something we should be doing, and I don't think there's anybody out there that's real pro healthcare acquired infections, unless you're a lawyer looking to cash in on that. But But there's confidentiality issues, there's the one facility in each town issue, and I think that's something that this committee, if it's formed, will have to wrap itself around and come up with a solution for us.
A last question, Mr. Chair. How do you define healthcare facility? I mean, would a surgical outpatient facility be required to report? Would a community health clinic be required to report? I mean, where do you draw the line?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I think what we've come up with here is we have a trying to find the right spot. A definition of healthcare facilities is somewhere in the bill here. We are looking at those outpatient clinics and the small clinics as well. Just skim through the bill here, but perhaps I think it's page 4. Line 12 on page 4 is section 4429.599 definitions, and number 3 gives the a healthcare facility meaning in there, and I think that's where we're massaging the language to include all of these other ones. May have to do so a little bit more checking into that particular statute and get back to you if you don't mind.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Actually, I do, Mr. Chairman, and probably be Dr. Butler that could probably answer these questions better if I could add and come on up to the up to the table.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Jay Butler. I'm Director of the Division of Public Health.
Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yeah, go ahead. We're going to bring him forward and have him put his two cents in, but okay. If you're all ready to rock and roll with him, we'll...
I guess one of the questions that I have has to do more with the Joint Commission accreditation that goes on with the hospitals, the JCO, and that's obviously a very important certification or standard to go ahead and achieve. In the past, I've worked in a number of hospitals that couldn't get there. Does this task force, with its report, is it going to adversely affect some of these JCO-approved facilities by the reporting that that's going to be done?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it certainly should not, and that would not be the intent of this working group. In fact, one of the issues that the working group established under SGR 19 spent a fair bit of time discussing was how do we achieve the goal of doing good infection control practices and encouraging that within hospitals without being repetitive in terms of the administrative burden that it places upon the hospital. So the goals of any kind of public reporting system would be to be coordinated with the JCO requirements.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, as we look at some of the hospital-acquired infections, I think it's important to go ahead and look at because we're looking at drug-resistant bacteria that are out there that can be fairly aggressive, the clostridials that are flesh-eating type of infections that, as of this morning, there was a report in the journal about the quadruple amputee who got an infection after a postpartum infection. And are these the kind of things you're trying to go after, or are there other things that you're more involved with, like the situation of the possible bird flu pandemic that has been threatening us for the last couple of years?
Well, through the chair, Senator Olson, I think there's two issues that this group could potentially address. One is the overall high rate of hospital or healthcare-associated infections. The most recent data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which was just published in the past month, suggests that there's about 1.7 million of these types of infections that occur in the country each year. And according to their methodology, it translates into about 98,000 associated deaths. To address an earlier question about whether or not we have that kind of data for the state of Alaska, we do not. But if we just do the simple calculation, which I was just doing on the BlackBerry-based calculator a few moments ago, we come up with somewhere around 150 to 200 deaths in the state of Alaska each year. That doesn't necessarily mean that these deaths, all of these deaths would be prevented by preventing hospital-acquired infections, but it does suggest that we can do better to protect patients in the healthcare environment. The other issue is that healthcare settings have become the breeding ground for some of our more difficult to treat bacterial infections. So the healthcare associated infections, the drug resistant infections, these are preventable, sometimes potentially preventable, but oftentimes preventable through basic infection control techniques, appropriate use of antibiotics, such as how antibiotics are used before and after surgical procedures, and through fairly simple administrative measures, such as facilities making sure that their workers are vaccinated against influenza each year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's probably little doubt that Alaska's statistics will end up any different than the nationwide ones, I would assume, and I've heard these numbers before, too. It's kind of surprised me when I first heard them, because they were comparing them to other causes of death in the United States, and I thought, wow, I don't know where it rated, but it was third or fourth or something like that. And what is required of hospitals now? Is there nothing required of them to at least approach this problem? I realize this is an important bill because it sets something in motion to try and collect the statistics and make sure we're looking at it, but in the long run, it's a poor business practice, as one of these other handouts indicates, for this to be happening in your hospital. You would think that by now there would be action taken. A lot of states have passed bills. There's been a lot of discussion about it. What is actually taking place from the hospital's point of view as far as what they're doing?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, it's a very complex question, and I think perhaps the most straightforward answer is that the market-based approach, or the best practices approach, hasn't yet fully been able to address the challenge of healthcare-associated infections. Some of that has been because of the nature of healthcare-associated infections themselves. Sometimes they're difficult to diagnose. Sometimes it's difficult to identify what has been acquired in the hospital versus what's come in from the community, although current epidemiological techniques have improved that capability. It also depends very much on how much the hospital is willing to invest in infection control, not only implementing infection control measures, but conducting the surveillance to be able to detect the problems that occur. The other challenge is that healthcare has certainly changed. As many of you may have heard me quote a colleague who said, "We send patients home who are sicker than the ones we used to admit to the hospital 20 years ago." More and more healthcare is provided outside of the hospital. So it's not as perhaps straightforward, as it might have been a few years ago. So it's a problem that I think has not been easy for the infection control community to entirely get a handle on.
And just one other. With the collection of the data, I didn't see anything that, you know, it talks about making recommendations. Would you anticipate that you would interpret this to mean that someone such as in your office would then be also reviewing and making recommendations as far as maybe Medicaid, Medicare reimbursements and or payments to facilities that do not make serious attempts to clean up their own situation?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has a component of the reimbursement side of infection control practices that we would not directly be involved in. Our role would be more in processing the data that is submitted from the hospitals and providing it in a form that's interpretable to the public. The working group established under SJR 19 spent a good deal of time discussing some of these challenges with this approach. I mean, first of all, there's no hard scientific data that public disclosure is going to reduce the rates of hospital-acquired infections. It's really consumers group that has driven this nationwide campaign. And the feeling being that consumers have a right to know what their risk is when they go into a healthcare environment. To date, 14 states have passed legislation requiring public disclosures, and those 14 laws are very different in terms of the type of data that is disclosed. Two states have required confidential reporting to state public health officials. The group also had a chance to review recommendations from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and those recommendations specifically include traditional public health reporting techniques, such as data going to the public health agency within the state for the disclosure, rather than the hospital just putting up whatever data they collect and would like to disclose publicly, to try and make it a level playing field among the hospitals as much as possible.
Thank you.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Doctor, for your testimony. The bill requires that health facilities report. What happens if they don't? Or what happens if they inaccurately report? Is there an audit function? Is there a penalty associated with not reporting or not telling the whole truth?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Elton, that is always one of the challenges in any public health reporting, is there's no public health police that goes out and finds the people who don't report. This would be something that, even if it's mandatory, it will require cooperation with the hospitals. Much of public health reporting is done in a somewhat collaborative method. It's based on a trust relationship and good interaction between the public health agency and the various healthcare facilities involved.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, it just seems to me that if the notion is we're going to induce better behavior by letting consumers know that we're creating an imperative that if you have a bad situation, you're going to try to weasel a little bit because people are going to be shopping elsewhere for their health care. And so it seems to me that if we pass something saying please do it, even if we pass something that says it's mandatory, if there's nothing that induces good behavior, that you might not always get good behavior given the fact that people will be making shopping decisions based on the information.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, you're again correct that it would be based fairly much on a trust relationship and the goodwill of the hospitals, that they are concerned about the welfare of their patients. Certainly the working group spent a fair bit of time also discussing the potential downsides of public disclosure. For instance, the facilities that have perhaps the best surveillance in place, the ones that identify the infections and report them, could potentially appear to have a higher rate of infections, and that's certainly not the intent of this effort by any means.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for the doctor? Senator Thomas.
Just one quickly, and I don't want to belabor the point, but on page 4, lines 27 through actually almost the end of the bill, it talks about timelines for doing something, and we're talking about, well, let's see, this is 07, 8, 9, 10, 11, so about 3 years, and I'm looking at one of the handouts that basically came from a hospital in Massachusetts, I believe. It is this one from the Boston Herald, anyhow, and it says that Paul Levy, president of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, created a big stir recently when he posted the hospital's infection rates on his blog and encouraged other hospitals to follow suit without a complicated state mandate. So I guess I'm just bringing it up since it was in the packet, that we're going to spend 3 or 4 years taking a look at something that we know already exists and not require those people to maybe report more rapidly to us so we can get on with it. But anyhow, just maybe not a question, a comment, I guess.
Yeah, I address that.
You can respond, yes.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Thomas. This actually gets back to some of the discussions we had in the working group also. The data is not necessarily collected in a very standardized fashion around the hospitals. If we are going to do this in Alaska, we would certainly like to do it right and be able to provide information that's useful for the hospitals as well as to healthcare consumers. We have some peculiar challenges in Alaska. We have only 6 hospitals with more than 50 beds, so we're dealing with fairly small numbers. And oftentimes we have areas where people really don't have much of a choice. So providing information in a fashion that's useful and ultimately going to improve health is part of the charge to the working group that would be established under this bill.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Doctor. In the Anchorage LIO, we have Pat Luby from the AARP. If you could please identify yourself and
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. AARP supports SB 62. As Senator Elton pointed out, this may not be as effective in terms of trying to give useful information to consumers since we don't have that many competitive hospitals like Chicago or Dallas. But what this bill is really about is error reductions. The Institute of Medicine has done a lot of studies about how hospitals and health professionals can help reduce errors simply by admitting to each other what the problems may have been. This is not a gotcha bill. We're not trying to catch hospitals. We're not trying to catch health professionals who may have made an error. What we want them to do is admit an error was made. Let's find out how it happened. And let's find out how we can prevent any future errors from happening. Our health professionals are very good about correcting problems, but they need to know the number and the scope of those problems. AARP feels that SB 62 is a good first step toward reducing those medical errors, and we encourage you to pass it in your committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Luby. Mayor, we'll go to the off-net to Sandra Stark. If you could please identify yourself and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, this is Sandra Stark in Homer, and my initial understanding and expectation of the bill was that it would deal with the individual hospitals and ways that they could improve and help to cut down healthcare-related infections. But there's another component that has arisen recently with input from some in the community that have had medical problems or know of medical problems. And it relates to the comment earlier that folks are not staying in a hospital as long as in yesteryear. And we all know in the state of Alaska, there's a lot of movement from community to community. And so I think this not only do we need to improve the situation at individual hospital, we've got to improve the health care throughout the state. And it doesn't matter whether you're going to a great big city hospital or a small little clinic. We had a case recently where someone was into town for a sport facility and they had an infection acquired elsewhere. And of course, bacteria take their time to grow, so you don't always have knowledge of a problem when you immediately leave where you might have inadvertently acquired it, and it arose later. Now, my guess is the institution that where this happened will never know about it. They'll never know that there's something they could do to prevent it, and I think they're probably doing a much better job today than they've ever done, and they're very well-meaning people, but because there's a lack of information exchange, there's, although we're in this together, we're not improving it together. And I think just shedding some light on what are the problems out there, and we think we're small in Alaska and we don't have them, but found just in this last month, we do have problems, and we share them between communities, and I think the whole state needs this, and it would be very helpful. And I think the individuals that are helping to do this with the guidance from questions such as I've heard today are going to make it so that it will be in the best interest and not a threat to the healthcare facilities. And thank you very much for considering this.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Letch, would you come forward? the fiscal notes noted here at starting at 185,000, going to 211,000, and we're trying to hold back not only the growth of the operating accounts, but control all these different boards and commissions that we seem to have a litany of all across the state. Would you like this? Do you have any comments on the fiscal note, or would you like to have the department comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's probably a more appropriate question for the department.
Okay. Is there somebody from the department that would like to come forward and speak to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that would be me. The fiscal note includes travel and meeting support for the working group, but also includes support within the department for staffing to be able to conduct this working group and to be able to manage data collected through an effort like this. It's not something that would be done necessarily very easily, and certainly we approached the fiscal note with the recognition that we wanted to do this as efficiently as possible. In really historically, public health has not interacted in the healthcare world very much. And I think this is in some ways unfortunate because healthcare has changed so much that now there is no longer that clear-cut line between the community and the healthcare environment anymore. So this is in many ways an expansion of the type of work that the Division of Public Health does, being involved with healthcare facilities in the day. And so it is important work, but not one that we should do to the detriment of other work. In other words, taking staff involved with the current activities in community health away from those activities.
I just in reference to Senator Thomas's earlier comment, if there isn't some other way to collect the data where the department could organize it and consolidate it and then maybe make recommendations without creation of another board. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it certainly would, Mr. Chairman, it certainly would be desirable to use that approach. The working group, I want to thank other members of the working group who may be here or on the line, and please feel free to speak up. But I think I would represent the conclusions of the working group that this issue was much more complicated than many of us realized as we got into it and began to examine the issue and realized it had a lot of technical aspects that really the working group we had put together could not tackle in the time frame that we had set for ourselves.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the issues that I want to bring up, what is the interaction between the CDC, which is a federally funded program, obviously, or already federally funded, and the state epidemiologist's office, and the numbers and the coordination is there? Why is it that the state epidemiologist, or is there going to be a reduction in the state epidemiologist's office and the funding that goes on there because this task force is in place?
Well, through the chair, Senator Olson, currently there are no federal funds related to healthcare related issues within states. Our epidemiology group is supported about 75% through federal funds, the remainder primarily through GF. There's no federal funding that we've been able to identify to be able to address this type of issue. The role of the CDC has been primarily technical consultation and advice and also communication through the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists to make sure that we're working in coordination with the learning experience in other states. But unfortunately, the data and information experience is shared, but the money to do this type of work has been a little harder to come by.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hill.
Thanks. Two questions, Mr. Chair. And the first one, pretty straightforward. The fiscal note runs out the costs through FY 2013, but the committee disappears at the end of FY 012, I think. Am I missing something here? And do we have an extra column? If I'm reading Section 6 of the bill correctly, it repeals the committee, or the committee sunsets it in 012.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, I may have to defer the question specifically about FY 13, perhaps to Mr. Letch. I will comment that part of the goal for this is we didn't want to commit to an unending process because there are a lot of unknowns, and we figured that it would be most appropriate to do this as a pilot, and after a period of assessment by the Technical Advisory Committee, decide whether or not this was something worth doing on an ongoing basis. The question specifically of when this program would sunset, I'm not sure, Doug, if you can address that or not.
Maybe, Mr. Letch, maybe what we can do, because I'm just watching the clock, and what we could do is just, we're going to end up setting this aside. We can maybe deal with some of these as we go forward. Also, we want to take a double check on the fiscal note, because it refers to the department's overhead costs, but we want to make sure it also includes board stand-up costs. And if there isn't some way we could get the health care facilities to absorb this cost versus the state, and just some areas to explore as while we set this aside.
Mr. Chair, just another question maybe for the future that they can prepare for is, given the fact that this is a voluntary program and given the fact that we expect the consumers are going to be making choices on where to go for their health care, maybe you could get back to the committee later. Does the state accept liability, for example, if a hospital doesn't report correctly? A consumer makes a health care choice based on the reporting by the department. Is there a potential liability issue for the state for passing on to the consumer information that they made a healthcare decision about?
Through the chair, Senator, that's a very good question, and I would have to get back with you on that one.
And with that, I'd like to go ahead and set this bill aside. Thank Mr. Letch and the good doctor for coming forward today. We'll move on to the second bill on the agenda. The intent here is to move this bill today. It's Senate Bill number 4, Revisions to the Senior Care Program. Senator Olson has been working with the administration and working on a refined fiscal note. And if we could have Senator Olson or his designated gal, Lady Ms. Osterman, come forward and explain the current position of this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Olson, and I'm the sponsor of the bill. Have been working not just with the department, but also with the other body that has a companion bill that's coming through. What Senate Bill 4 essentially does is it extends the program sunset date 4 years to end on June 30, 2011. It removes the underutilized prescription drug benefit program, establishes 3 monthly payouts, $175 for seniors who fall below the 100% of the federal poverty guidelines adjusted for Alaska, $150 for those seniors who do not exceed the 135 percentile, and $100 a month for those seniors whose household income does not exceed 150% of the federal guidelines. There is no asset test to this bill. Mainly having to do because we got a fair amount of input from those seniors out there that had a small amount of money to cover their funeral expenses so that when they died, they were not able to, were not going to be a burden to their family members that would have to absorb the cost otherwise. And that to make sure that this was so that seniors who, if for some reason, the longevity program was re-implemented, that seniors would not be able to take advantage of both programs, essentially double dipping, so this cuts that out. The Health and Social Services estimates there are 7,800 seniors that are going to qualify for under SB4 and the fiscal note of $17.4 million for the FY08 budget is what's been fine-tuned over the last 24 hours. And with that, we have my senior aide, Ms. Ginny Osterman, who's also available for questions and also has a comment on it this morning.
Through the chair, I think Senator Olson has covered the bill quite well. We do have a complete fiscal note too today.
We have somebody from the department that wants to walk us through this fiscal note? Probably not, but do we have somebody from the department that would come forward and walk us through the fiscal note? This is a fairly substantial fiscal note. This is the biggest one this committee's looked at this year as far as moving forward. We're trying to hold back our operating accounts growth. So this is, from a financial perspective, going counter to the direction. Although we recognize that we're trying to deal with some senior issues and help the needy in our state. So there's kind of a balance between numerics and taking care of some social issues. So if you could please walk us through this fiscal note, I'd appreciate it.
For the record, Janet Clark with the Department of Health and Social Services. The fiscal note we delivered this morning is a comprehensive fiscal note for the cost of the senior care program. I will, for the record, make sure the committee knows that senior care has existed for at least three previous years. So while this is a comprehensive fiscal note, has the total cost of the senior care program, there have been budgets in the past for senior care of approximately $12 million. So if you're looking to compare the increase, that's generally the increase. As you can see, Mr. Chairman, we've included the administrative costs as well as the benefit cost, and the total for FY 2008 is $17,398,900. I think the best page to go to is page 3. There are the bulk of the costs of the program are the actual payments to seniors, the cash benefits for seniors. So as you can see in the tables on page 3, we've estimated the caseload for each poverty level based on the legislation that had the differing benefit amounts in the legislation depending on the income and where the individual might be in that. So we've estimated there are 5,000 estimated individuals who will qualify at less than 100% of the federal poverty level. They would receive $175 per month for a total cost of $10,500,000. And again, the next level, we estimate 2,643 individuals at $150 per month for $4.7 million. And then the upper level, between 135% of poverty and 150%, 1,157 at $100 per month for a total of $1,388.4 million. So the benefits cost are the bulk of the expenditures for the senior care program, and they total $16.6 million. Then, Mr. Chairman, on the administrative side, we continue to show the cost related to existing staff that have been funded from previous appropriations for senior care. We add some additional staff based on the increasing complexity of this program as compared to the previous program, where it was a flat $120 per month at 135% of poverty for the cash benefits. So we have added additional staff and administrative costs into the legislation.
So with the advent of computers and all this fancy modernization, why do we have to expand staffing level to deal with this issue versus automation. We're trying to reduce the headcount, not increase the headcount.
Mr. Chairman, it's based on caseload. If they're increasing cases, we have, you know, workers who can work only so many cases. If you increase caseload, which this bill would, then there are additional numbers of staff who are needed. But Ms. Fitzgerald can talk specifically about that, those administrative assumptions.
And I mean, when you address that, could you give us a feel for how much cushion you have in those numbers or where the department is as far as how you, what you feel the accuracy of the need of those additional staff levels are?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Ellie Fitzgerald, and I'm the Division Director for Public Assistance. As Ms. Clark pointed out, the two additional staff are primarily for the increased caseload. Currently, we have about 7,000 seniors receiving benefits from the Senior Care Program. This bill would increase that number to 8,800 seniors. So that's an additional 1,800 seniors who would be applying for benefits and receiving benefits each year. And as part of that process, it's the application process, it's gathering information about their income to determine their eligibility, input into our computer system. And you know, from looking at what staff are currently able to manage, and as Janet pointed out, the increased complexity in looking at incomes, we estimate two staff will be needed to do that extra work. And that's in addition to some minor changes to our computer system to allow those payments to go out as, at different levels as well.
Mr. Chairman, I would add that we have added in the notes those items that we think are one-time costs in FY08, so could be backed out in FY09 in the budget process once that work is done.
So when we look at putting in this program, as we all understand, we're enhancing this, it's very difficult to eliminate it or reduce it. It's much easier to expand it. And I assume in 2012, where the fiscal note zeroes out, that's probably an underestimation of what this committee will actually be looking at. Have you, or has the department looked at the aging trends in the state and look forward beyond the 4 years as far as what we're actually setting up here, because this may run substantially longer than 11 years.
Mr. Chairman, we have used existing databases for the Adult Public Assistance Program for looking at the senior population. We've also looked at the recently completed Lewin study on Medicaid and the forecast for that aging population, and it showed a fairly flat growth trend for the senior population for the next 8 to 10 years, and then that growth rate really does increase substantially. So within the time frames of the fiscal note, we looked at those estimated demographics to estimate the additional caseload. We do show that the fiscal note is zero in 2012 because the legislation sunsets the program after 2011, so that's why that is zero.
We have any other questions? Yes, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The prescription, the underutilized prescription program was dropped. Do you know what contributed to it being underutilized, and where do those people go now?
Senator Thomas, through the chair. The underutilization of the prescription drug program is something that we were very concerned about, and we did a survey of seniors to ask questions about why they were not accessing the program. And the information from the survey told us that essentially that the prescription drug benefit wasn't what they needed, that they have other prescription drug benefit insurance available through other insurance programs, or through pension benefits, or through the new Medicare Part D program, and that wasn't a need for them. So that, I hope that's answered your question. That was primarily what we learned from asking seniors about it.
Was there any indication for those that were utilizing it? Must have been some that didn't have some of the others. What do, is there an alternative for them?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, there are about 140 seniors who are currently utilizing the prescription drug benefit. And in working with Senator Olson, I think that that's part of his interest in wanting to raise the income limit so that some of those seniors will qualify under the new program with the higher income test. Currently, the senior care program is frozen at the 2005 federal poverty guidelines, so those income levels are much smaller.
Thank you.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. This is a semi-follow-up to the comment that the chair made previously. I realize that the program sunsets, but I think it would be, I mean, given the nature of things and how difficult it is to get rid of a program once you have it, it would be instructive, I think, if at some point, and I realize we're moving the bill out today, you could give us an estimate of what you expect the cost of the program would be in 2020. I mean, I'm the leading edge of the bubble that is coming. And everything I have heard, the Department of Labor statistics all demonstrate that there are a lot more of me coming than there are people right now who are eligible for the program. So if you could do that for me, it would be helpful. And if you could also tell me whether or not the numbers in the fiscal note are predicated upon the assumption that the federal poverty level stays where it is now, or did you factor in any notion that federal poverty level guidelines change and that they will be going up?
Senator Elton, through the chair, the fiscal note does factor in the federal poverty guidelines increasing each year as the income limits increasing as the federal poverty guidelines increase.
Okay.
So, yes, we have factored that in.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So if I understand, if I didn't misinterpret the earlier conversation, we were talking about staffing levels and holding the headcount down. Could you implement this program with two additional employees versus a total of six? Or did I misunderstand what you were saying?
Mr. Chairman, we have an existing staff level of four. We're planning to add two for a total of six.
Okay. So we want to just make sure that that's clear on the record as far as the intent here. Isn't an additional six, but an additional two.
That's correct.
We have any other comments? Seeing a clean sheet on the sign in. And do we have anybody on the off net? Any closing comments? Senator Olson, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move Senate Bill 4 from committee with individual recommendation and accompanying fiscal notes on to the next committee.
We have a motion on the table to move the bill. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll move the bill with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations and note we're looking at a possible staff increase of two versus six additions as we move forward. That concludes the business today of the committee.
Congratulations, Jim.
Tomorrow at 9 a.m., we'll gather again. Co-chair Senator Hoffman will be chairing the meeting, and we'll begin working on the operating budgets as we move forward. Thank you very much for coming, and meeting adjourned.